A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome once again to PQRST. And both of our regular listeners have probably realized that it has been over a year since since the first episode of PQRST came down the pike. I've been thinking about annual things quite a bit lately because Friday, a couple days ago, today's Monday, so it was a couple days ago, Friday, October 7th, marked one entire year since I got on stage to do comedy and did an hour's worth of stand-up comedy for the... What in the world did we call the show? It wasn't Stand Up and Deliver. That was Bovine Metropolis. For whatever the show was called at Lakewood Cultural Center. And it was very important to me at the time, but right this second, I cannot recall what we called it. But anyway, if you had told me that night that a year later I would be taking a break from doing stand-up and that the video made that night would not have gone to any churches or establishments or anywhere trying to get work, I would have been very surprised. But, well, A, I believe I'm where I should be, where God would have me. I am at peace with where I am, so I will take that over having done a ton of things in the meantime and not being at peace. And really had the chance Friday, October 7th, to think about how my life had changed, because Friday, October 7th of 2016 was marked the nine... Do we really count anniversaries? I'm going to start this sentence over. Friday, October 7th, my son turned 9 months old. And to realize, even though it was actually a bit of a difficult day last Friday because he is teething and let the world know about it, was still a better day than October 7th of 2015, even though on 2015's October 7th, I got to do an hour of stand-up before an appreciative audience, and that was a highlight of my life. I have a son now, and I get to watch him grow every day, and October 7th, last Friday, was 9 months since he came out and into this world, and so it was a better day, just because he's here with us. So if the time comes at some point in the future where I get to both spend the day with my son and do an hour of stand-up comedy, well, that'll be probably a better day all on its own. But this was a good one, and today's been a good one, and I hope I'm not done doing stand-up. I really do. But right now, it's okay that I'm not. I am hoping to get back into improv. Ooh, that's a fun story. The Friday before last, so more than a week ago, my hot wife and I and my friends Jonathan and Danette, we all went down to Colorado Springs and we got to see the Who's Live Is It Anyway show. We were in the third row because Danette Troyer is awesome, and because both she and John and Tiffany are awesome. They went in together. I don't know what the tickets cost because it was a birthday present, but it's probably more than a dollar. To be in the third row and see Greg Proops and Ryan Stiles, I mean, we could see right up Ryan Stiles' nose, which, hey, if you haven't been able to do that, it's an experience. And Bob Berkesh, who did the music for Drew Carey's Improvaganza, and that's something else I highly recommend. You may have seen Whose Line, but YouTube Drew Carey's Improvaganza, if you get the chance. It was like Whose Line, only even better. And they did sketches, and my wife was even in one. They did sound effects, and Tiffany was chosen to be the sound effect-y for Ryan Stiles. And it was fantastic. Seeing about a couple miners trying to get into a mine, and she got to do what they considered a gay horse. She got to be half of a choo-choo train. There was all sorts of fun happening, and it was a blast. So even if I hadn't already decided, man, I want to get back into improv, that probably would have kickstarted me. And there's a group that has auditions August and January, and I missed the August auditions by a week with the whole epiphany, hey, I want to get back into improv. So we are cooling our heels and waiting for January. And so this season, right now, it's just a time to not be getting on stage and to be okay with that. And I am. But this podcast is about funny things, and so what in the world am I going to talk about? Well, I have a thing. In fact, I have the start of a new thing with PQRST, and I will set up a little bit because it's a long story and I don't need to tell all of it on this particular podcast. But a few years back, well, we'll go even further back than that. I've mentioned on this recording before that I started writing my first novel when I was 10. I was still trying to write a published novel when I was hit 30. And it's not that I had never completed one. I've actually completed quite a few, almost into double digits. But still have not ever seen any of them get to the level that somebody would want to take and publish them. I know self-publishing is a thing, but as far as fiction goes, I didn't want to. But I had a lot of practice writing, and so when I had this idea, it's like, hey, there are books out there in the world where people nitpick popular culture, nitpicking of movies, nitpicking of TV shows. Phil Ferrand is a very prolific writer, or at least was. I think most of his books, at least on this subject, were done in the 90s or so, but he wrote The Nitpicker's Guide to the Next Generation, Star Trek, and The Nitpicker's Guide to Classic Star Trek, and Deep Space Nine, and then X-Files, for some reason. And so that exists, and there are other books. I used to get them out of the library as a kid, Film Flubs, Movie Bloopers, found The Nitpicker's Guide to Star Wars Saga, written, which is another story all in itself, and I will tell that one when I get to the appropriate podcast episode, but suffice to say, there are books, it's a very small niche, but there are books about nitpicking, and I thought, hey, there's an idea. I could watch, because a lot of people love movies, I won't say everybody, but almost everybody loves movies, I could watch the top 50 grossing movies of all time, nitpick them, and somebody would buy that as a series. And I really, really thought somebody would. Again, more story on a later date, because we're already 7 minutes into this, and I haven't even started the main thrust of this podcast. But what I'm about to do started as a blog. I said, I'm going to write the top 50 grossing movies of all time. I'll put a blog together. And when millions of people love it, or tens of people at least, then I can go to a publisher and publish a series. And the first, at the time, the 50th grossing movie, highest gross, was King Kong. Peter Jackson's King Kong. Chances are, I didn't look before I started this, probably should have, but if I was to look at the top 50 grossing movies of all time, King Kong wouldn't be there. It might not even be in the 100 grossing movies of all time by now, because it was 50th when I started this, and I started this in 2008, if I'm not mistaken. So 8 years ago, lots of things have changed, and it seems like almost every big blockbusting movie that comes out now is knocking one of the top 100 off the previous list, so King Kong might not even be there, but it's the one I started with. And first off, some ruminations about the movie in and of itself. And I did forget to do a bit of research before I started this, so I'm going to do it now. You're going to come with me as we go to the land of Google. The land of Google. The land of Google. Peter Jackson's filmography, Peter Jackson movies, because I know that The Lord of the Rings was not his first, and what I'm trying to remember, I know there were two before there was The Lord of the Rings. Were there more of those? There were, it would seem. I see Heavenly Creatures was 94, and Dead Alive was 92. Well, he's been involved in movies. Maybe what I should have said was Peter Jackson, director. You still there? You hanging on with me? I really appreciate for it. Peter Jackson, let's just go to IMDb. Have you ever been to IMDb? IMDb is the Internet Movie Database. And if you haven't, what is keeping you? I mean, it's fantastic because anytime, and I mean anytime, that you say, hey, I know that guy from somebody. Where is it? Thank you, Franklin. You go to the Internet Movie Database, and you can look up what you know them from. And it is wonderful to be allowed to do that. I'm still, can you tell I'm stalling? Still trying to get IMDb, Peter Jackson, to open up. Why are you doing this? Well, because I would be willing to guess that most people, you say Peter Jackson, if they know him at all, they know him for the Lord of the Rings series, and then maybe King Kong. Here we go. Now I'm finally pulling up the director. And then, of course, there's the three Hobbit movies. That could have been one movie. Yeah, but they made it into three. I may get into more of that when I go back to The Lord of the Rings. Anyway, as a director, since 1987, I was wrong. There were, I'm counting, six or seven movies that Peter Jackson made. So it was not like he was the first-time director. But let's see if you've heard of any of these. Bad Taste, Meet the Feebles, Dead Alive, Heavenly Creatures, Forgotten Silver, The Frighteners. Any of those ring a bell? I didn't think so, because then it jumps to The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, The Two Towers, The Return of the King. And it would probably be very interesting to, you know, watch a documentary or look up how in the world he went from being a fairly unknown, I won't say B-movie, I haven't seen them, how can I say? I'll say fairly unknown movie director to having the keys to an enormous franchise, The Lord of the Rings. And I will go to bat saying that while I agree that they can be a little lengthy, and if you're not as big a fan of The Lord of the Rings as I myself am, I could see not even wanting to sit through the regular version, much less the extended version, he really knocked it out of the park. So somehow he got the keys to this enormous franchise. And I'll talk more about Lord of the Rings when I get to the Lord of the Rings, because you better believe that those movies were in the top grossing ones, and so I got to nitpick. At least The Fellowship of the Ring. I would have to look up and see if the other two were in the top 50, but The Fellowship was. He did a bang-up job. Again, more on that with that podcast. But the thing that happened, and continues apparently to happen, because The Hobbit trilogy, it didn't need to be three movies. Could have been one really tight, fantastic movie. But no, it had to be three. And we had to make a completely made-up, Tolkien never for a moment wrote anything about this plot involving a hobbit falling in love with an elf. Yeah, it had to be three movies because that's what Peter Jackson does. Well, in between the Lord of the Rings trilogy, which was fantastic, and which I have very little, I can nitpick it, but I have very little gripes with. I'm just glad it exists because it's wonderful. And again, when I get to the Lord of the Rings podcast, I will tell you about, there are several animated versions, one of which is only sort of half bad, and one of which is god-awful. The Lord of the Rings trilogy, what he did with it was fantastic. And so my guess is that coming off that, he could write his own ticket. He had made New Line Studios and whichever studio was, I'm not going to look it up, you can look it up, the studio that released Lord of the Rings, he made them whole bunches of money. Might have been Warner Brothers. And so when he said, and this is all conjecture, I haven't looked it up, I could be wrong, I'm probably not though, when he said, hey, let's do King Kong, let's remake King Kong and do it right, they said, sure, and threw a bunch of money at him. And so what you have, if you have seen King Kong, is a beautiful, epic adventure that is way, way, enormously way too long. King Kong, as released in whatever 2000 and whatever it was by Peter Jackson, is way too long. And that's my first thing I want to say about this movie. So that's what we're doing. I've pulled the blog that I wrote. In fact, I pulled all of what I wrote that didn't make it into the blog that made it into the nonfiction book, and I'll tell you more about that next time. But all the pages of what I did for King Kong, and we're going to go through and look at what I found. And the first thing that I found was that the movie is just ridiculously too long. And in fact, while I was watching through and nitpicking it, there's this subplot with Jimmy, I don't know, one of the characters, that he's such a bad boy, and the character is so memorable, I couldn't even tell you, you know, more about it. I just know that the subplot didn't go anywhere. There's the ice skating scene with King Kong and Darrow, and you're going to hear more about that later. But beyond that, there's this brontosaurus stampede. It's incredibly CGI. It's beautiful. Why does it have to go on for like 20 minutes? There's the giant spider/bug killing scene, which I couldn't even watch that to nitpick it. I don't think I watched all of it in theaters. I saw, ooh, a giant spider. Let's look at the floor of the theater. Boy, somebody needs to sweep this up. Huh, still looking at the floor. Always looking at the theater floor. The T-Rexes scrambling around in the vines. They're just, these CGI scenes went on and on and on. And so when I nitpicked this movie, I had a little stopwatch next to me, and I kept track of the scenes in the film that did nothing to advance the rather thin plot. 45 minutes, okay? 45 minutes of this, I believe it was 3-hour film, could have been cut out. In fact, it must have been longer than that, because the 45 minutes I wrote down, that's one quarter of the film you could cut out and lose nothing. So, Peter Jackson, come on. So that's my rant for Parody Quips, Rants, and Storytelling. 45 minutes of King Kong is absolutely useless. And what is the matter with you? Moving on. Now, when I do my nitpicking, because I probably should explain a little bit about that, I look for things like you'll find in film flubs where it's like, oh, hey, you see a boom mic. Or, hey, the character picked up, you know, a full cup, and then one frame later, the cup's empty. Or the car was red and now it's white, that sort of thing. I'm probably not going to share a lot of those. If you really are interested in those sorts of things, and some people are, please email me and I will send you the King Kong. I'll send you the whole book. I'd be delighted for you to have it. So videoninja@juno.com if you really want to hear more. The ones that I'm going to share are the ones that probably I could have more fun with, because the goal of this whole podcast is to be funny. How am I doing so far? Don't answer that. And there is also, when I nitpicked these movies, I would pick the very best, the most ridiculous, the most atrocious scene or plot hole or notion of a movie and give it the Will Award, and that will be coming up in quite a while. Now, as I read through the pages that I wrote, it took me about 5 minutes into the movie before I found any nits at all, and more than a half hour into the movie before I found anything that wasn't like, you know, oh, well, for a depression, there's an awful lot of lights on in the city, or, you know, that pen he's using, I don't think that's a 1930s pen. But here we are, about 37 minutes into the movie. Jack Denham is this filmmaker that wants to go to Monster Island or Skull Island or Big Scary Gorilla Island, and nobody thinks it's out there. There's nothing out there. He's not going to find anything. He's mad. And the captain is like, I'm going back. And Jack Black's character's like, no, don't do it. And the captain's like, there's nothing out there. And Jack's like, well, then you have nothing to lose. Sure, except time and fuel and the cost of keeping up the equipment and paying the men. It's money that I'm never going to get from you, Mr. Broke Crazy Movie Maker. So they get closer to Monster Scary Giant Gorilla Island, and the compass goes all screwy, floopy, wobbly. Just like in Stranger Things. Anyway, that was very good. And not, you know, you could even pause this. Go watch all of Stranger Things, all 8 episodes right now, if you haven't seen it. I'll wait. You're back? Good. I told you. Yeah, gotta love 11. Anyway, the compass is going all screwy. And now you understand that reference because you've seen Stranger Things. The Venture, the ship, ventures. It's well named, the ship goes right into a fog bank, and it's so thick you can't see 5 yards in front of the ship. But when the captain says, hey, wait, we should slow down, it's like a minute before the ship alters course. You can't see 5 feet in front of the ship, or did I say 5 yards? Okay, well, you can't see 15 feet in front of the ship, but they go blindly into this fog for a minute before he decides, you know what, maybe I ought to slow down. Oh, and this, too, the Venture sails up to this island, and it's smooth sailing. Then they decide, you know what, let's get out of here, and suddenly there's rocks everywhere. Speaking of, as I said earlier, the fact that it just took way too long to get into this movie, it's almost an hour into the film before we finally step onto Skull Island. Peter Jackson, come on. I have a life outside of this film. 54 minutes, 51 seconds into the movie. Why doesn't he turn back? There's a part of him that wants to, but another part needs to know, needs to face the thing that makes him afraid. Okay, in the writing world, we call this telling instead of showing. If we don't know an hour into the film that Jack Denham, the filmmaker, has to find out the secret of this island, regardless of the cost, then we're never going to. And so this bit of dialogue was absolutely useless. Now, on the way to the island, they encounter this terrible storm, and they decide, we need to throw overboard anything that isn't bolted down. That's a quote from the movie, anything that isn't bolted down. Well, sure, it's a good thing that they bolted down the crates with all the big guns in them, because, hey, we have a large supply of very heavy guns just sitting around here, plus ammunition for them. We find the island, we get to the island, you know the story. The monster, the giant gorilla, makes his appearance, and somehow, rather than staying safely on board, this fragile female is there, and he decides to take her as his little my-size Barbie plaything. Well, it's just a regular Barbie to him, but anyway. The way that he swings her around, it is absolutely miraculous that Anne's neck doesn't snap. I mean, seriously, he's loping along the ground. Every step he takes, she's going up and down. She's being thrown around. I know a guy who broke his collarbone rolling into, we're playing in a park. It wasn't an official end zone. Rolling into the unofficial end zone. Nobody even touched him. He just decided when he was done running with the ball to do a roll to be all clever and got up saying, okay, ow, and he had broken his collarbone. It is amazing. I don't know what Anne is made of, but absolutely astonishing that she could survive that. An hour and 20 into this movie, I bothered pausing and noticing, you know, no one ever remotely tries to explain how or why this island has sheltered giant gorillas and dinosaurs and huge bugs and vampire bats and spiders. Everything on this island is huge, except the natives. What is the deal with that? This happens in movies a lot, too. About a minute or so after that moment, our heroes, as they are standing around in this canyon, and up from on top of them, rocks start falling. Now, I'm sorry, if I'm standing in a canyon and a rock of any sort of size, even a pebble, lands near me, I'm going to look up and then I'm going to back up. They look up, but they just kind of stand there. Nobody covers their heads, nobody moves away from the walls. These guys are made of really, really sterner stuff. And then we get to the Velociraptor chase. Did you watch the Brontosaurus stampede? Yeah. That's one of the moments that even fast-forwarding through it was too long. And then there's Velociraptors, because of course there were. And it's really lucky for the humans that the Velociraptors don't take them on instead of the Brontosauruses that are like 40 times or Brachiosauruses, whatever they are. They're 40 times bigger than them. 1 hour, 31 minutes, 30 seconds. This is not a nit, but can you even begin to imagine how bad a 30-foot gorilla's breath must be? I mean, assuming everything else scales up, you know, I'm pretty sure, you know? I don't know. This is just conjecture, but I'm willing to admit that a regular-sized gorilla, that their breath is probably not too fresh. And this guy lives, you know, with giant bugs. So, here's one of the main things about the movie. The gorilla decides that this little human female is a wonderful toy, and she decides, you know what, I will just play it up. The point, it's an hour and a half into the movie where Anne Darrow, played by Naomi Watts, who, poor girl, she did not get to wear a lot of clothing for most of this movie, she gets to do her vaudeville routine for the giant gorilla. Why? What possible purpose would there be? Oh, that's right, because why not? It's a giant gorilla. I will say, if she, Naomi Watts, is actually doing the juggling that Anne Darrow does in the scene where she juggles, she is really good. Maybe it's CGI. It didn't look like it was CGI. It looked real, and that's a darn good trick. And it was, again, in this scene, you just look into those big brown eyes. I'm talking about King Kong's. Those enormous satellite dish-sized brown eyes. He's just a big gorilla who wants to be loved. He's not evil. He's not even really an animal. Somehow, he's... Well, he's not human, but... The filmmakers seem to want to make us believe that he's human. Yeah, and again with... And this is at 1:45:20. Again with Anne, it's amazing that she wasn't destroyed. Because do you remember the scene between King Kong and the three T-Rexes? Where they just want a little Barbie snack. And King Kong by this time is like, no, she's mine and I'm going to fight for her. And Anne gets thrown around every which way and somehow doesn't break anything. Listen, I know somebody who broke a toe on a plastic laundry basket. I almost gave that the Will Award, but it's not even close to being the worst thing about this film. And I also praised the makers of the flimsy underthings that Anne was wearing. As Anne swings around between two dinosaurs and a raging giant gorilla, I can't help but wonder at the strength of the flimsy underthings she's been wearing all day. Not a rip, not a popped seam. 1930s silk had some chutzpah. And one of the reasons I shared that is because I like the word chutzpah. And I will say it's very nice of the filmmakers not to show us the scat, if you will, that a 30-foot gorilla, not to mention giant dinosaurs, leave lying around on this island. There's something else I'm glad the filmmakers don't show us, but I'll talk about that in a little bit. I don't know if there were nits in the 6-minute-long huge spider-killing scene, but I can't watch it again. I just can't watch 6 minutes of giant spiders being killed. That was a scene that didn't need to be more than 30 seconds, maybe a minute, and it's 6, and I'm not going to watch it. You can watch it if you want. If you find any nits, good for you. But even as I was fast-forwarding, I noticed something. I don't even remember his name. He was the actor that was brought along to do this film that Jack Denham wanted to do, and he's, you know, a coward. He's swinging on a rope. He's got a Thompson submachine gun, also known as a Tommy gun, in his hand, and he's firing wildly while swinging on a rope. What do you plan to do with that? You're going to hit somebody you're not aiming at, that's what. So, 2 hours and 30 seconds into the film, I wonder if any scientists, research scientists, who actually work with gorillas, watch this movie, and I wonder just how hard they laughed. Anne begins to... She gets this idea, wait a minute, maybe I can communicate with a giant gorilla, so she uses sign language, and it works right away. I mean, immediately, King Kong picks up what she's trying to communicate. And so I could just hear the researchers saying, oh, stupid me, if I just got a blonde in a nightgown, they figured out right away. We'll save years. The floor of the giant vampire bat cave is also remarkably clean. These animals are really, really fantastic housekeepers, as opposed to bats in the real world. Do you ever see the Planet Earth episode Caves? Yeah, there was a mountain of what bats leave behind. Let's move on. Well, you know, I was wrong. I said they were great housekeepers, but as Jack sneaks through this cave and past a giant gorilla skeleton, it's covered in cobwebs. How are giant spiders around long enough to make cobwebs in a lair of a giant vampire bat? And why do I have to sit here thinking about cobwebs and giant spiders and giant vampire bats? Again, let's move on. Oh, this movie had so much wrong with it. So, what this whole movie, what they want you to buy, there's two very big things that they feel you need to accept to enjoy this movie, and I think both of them are ridiculous. And I don't know which is more ridiculous. One, that the blonde woman, why do I call her the blonde woman? That Anne Darrow, played by the very lovely Naomi Watts, that she could really feel deeply for King Kong. And the other is even sillier, and again, I'll save it for later. But 2 hours, 13 minutes into this movie, King Kong has been captured. He's netted, he's hooked, he's chloroformed. And we're supposed to agree with Anne that it's a horrible, horrible, horrible thing they're doing to the giant gorilla. In the sense that they're capturing him to take him back to New York and say, hey, look at what we found, aren't we amazing? I'm totally on board. That's a horrible thing to do to an animal. But see, Anne doesn't know that's what they're doing. She doesn't know that they're going to take this thing and get it on the ship somehow. And you notice the filmmakers don't show us that scene. And take him back to be a curiosity. And, you know, then sell gorilla burgers. She, for all she knows, they've come to this island to shoot a film. They discovered this island has a giant gorilla. They have subdued him. And now they're going to get the ever-loving heck out of there. She doesn't know that's what they're doing. Maybe they're just trying to save everybody's life. And if they don't do something, obviously the rest of her short life is going to be as a giant gorilla toy. I can understand some remorse for the poor creature, but in this scene, she acts almost as if she's in love with the giant gorilla. And if you think that's a tough one to swallow, again, it gets worse. So, before they even get off the island, another thing I thought about. This, again, poor Anne Darrow. She's been running through the jungle. She ran across a splendory bridge. She ran down some stone rock steps. She ran through a cave. She's been barefoot this entire time. Owie, 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 owie. So, I don't even... Maybe I should have watched this film again before commenting on this, because I'm looking at nits and I'm like, I don't even know what was happening at this time. Oh, so apparently, even though the gorilla was chloroformed, he wakes up again. And probably takes out a couple more crew members. But don't worry, we have plenty of them down in cold storage. 2:14:26. Anne whispers to the gorilla, go back. And apparently he's learned English. But two, She seems to think that if King Kong will just let her go and return to his island, the creature could live out his life in peace. Does she know nothing about man? We found this island, and we're just going to pretend it doesn't exist. Welcome to Giant Island Theme Park. Please have your tickets ready. No outside food or drink. Mind the giant spiders. Now, one thing I haven't done in this is a lot of just regular nitpicking, but this one is fun. 2:14:48. Anne is trying to keep the captain from firing his harpoon, you know, because she loves the creature. But the harpoon that the captain has, there's a rope connected to it until the moment he fires it, and suddenly the rope disappears. So that's something to look for. And again, there are a bunch of these, but I keep going on about it. As they finally take King Kong down, Anne looks like her world is coming to an end. And I just wonder, if it was one of the T-Rexes that were coming after them, would she look like this? Of course not. She would volunteer to fire the harpoon. Has she discovered the giant gorilla has a soul? Is it those, you know, satellite dish-sized brown eyes? He ran off in the forest with her to make her his, you know, Barbie plaything. Seriously, she's not even remotely thankful that she's free of the creature. And by the way, where'd all the crazy islanders go? Once Kong comes on the scene, we never see them again. Yep. So, Jack Denham, his name will be up in lights on Broadway. Kong, the eighth wonder of the world. And then they fade to black. And when we come back, they're in New York. So, they just gloss over the fact that King Kong has killed a whole bunch of crew members. But apparently there's more where that came from. And I would really be interested to know how in the world they get the 8,000-pound gorilla back to the ship, onto the ship, and the ship home. But it would be a short movie. Well, a shorter movie, because it's already well over 2 hours at this point. We haven't even gotten back to New York. So they've got King Kong on stage, 2 hours, 25 minutes into this movie, and Kong is drowning in sorrow. Now, he doesn't appear to be chloroformed. It looks like he's just, you know, just chained. The lights don't matter. The noise doesn't matter. The chains doesn't matter because, oh, where is my 5-foot-5-inch Mattel toy? Where is that blonde woman that was so important to me? Seriously, the monster is apparently depressed. I don't have to call him a monster. He's just an animal, although be it a very large one. The animal is apparently depressed because the little plaything has gone away. Do you sense the Will Award coming up? Because it is. King Kong escapes from the theater, as we all knew he would. Jack, our hero, has grabbed Anne, our heroine, and they are driving through the city of New York, trying to escape him. 2:34:33, another classic movie nit. Kong rips the windshield half off the car Jack is driving, and then we go to a close-up shot, and there just is no windshield. And then we go back to the wide, and hey, it's half there again. And then shortly thereafter, King Kong flips the 1930s cab that Jack is driving. This cab has no safety devices to speak of. It's 30 years before they're going to have seatbelts. He's knocked unconscious, but in no other way is he injured. They really made guys tough back in the 30s, I will say. 2:35:34. Yeah, I understand that things have to happen in a coincidental way, or else the film would take forever. I mean, Anne has come out of her theater, which is not the same theater as King Kong's, and is, you know, so they're two different theaters, but we have to get these two crazy kids together. And if he rumbles around New York for 20 minutes trying to find her, this already incredibly too long movie would be even worse. But Jack, scrambling through the streets, trying to get away from the giant gorilla, Kong finally stops him, turns around, and Anne Darrow is standing right there.
Out of all the streets in New York, you had to bring your dance costume into mine.
And at 2:36:38, I awarded the Will Award. Award, award, award. Because I can't stand it any longer. The rampaging giant gorilla stops in his tracks to stare in wonder at Anne Darrow. This is a wild animal. This is a completely unknown environment. He's just pulled free from huge chains to escape his captors, but apparently all he wanted to do was find the woman that he loves. That's right. We're supposed to swallow the idea that the giant gorilla has fallen in love with Naomi Watts. Yeah, with a 100 or so pound female, no larger than one of the bamboo shoots he used to eat for lunch. Ding, 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 ding. It's the Will Award. Come on, Peter Jackson. I don't care if that's how the classic movie went. I don't know. I don't remember. It's just a ridiculous concept. And right after it, Anne returns his love. She goes to the giant gorilla, lets him pick her up, because she remembers fondly their time on the island. One wonders what the children will look like. Hopefully, they get her nose. Here's something else I'll bet you didn't think of. I didn't until I was nitpicking, but it's the sort of thing I do think about. We've been watching this gorilla gallivant around for what feels like days. There's not a hint of certain body parts, shall we say, that a male gorilla should be swinging around. I don't think King Kong is female. Now, listen, I'm thankful we're not seeing a 35-foot gorilla's junk. I'm just saying I'm wondering where it went. Granted, it is cold in New York in wintertime. King Kong and his new girlfriend, you know, walk, blah, gallivant, whatever. They go down the street. Nobody's looking out a window. I mean, I know New Yorkers are blasé, but come on. Now that we found love, what are we gonna do with it? Well, here's a good first date idea. Go ice skating. I can't believe I would have made it 2 hours and 38 minutes into this film without finally saying, okay, come on. But this feels like when I was in the theater, the moment where I was like, you have got to be kidding me. King Kong and Anne Darrow go ice skating. I mean, okay, King Kong is, you know, just kind of sliding around. He doesn't have skates on, but that's basically the concept. They're going ice skating. It's a first date. This is so incredibly ridiculous. And where have all the cops gone? Didn't King Kong just break out of a theater? Are they having trouble in the snow? It's not like there aren't giant footprints to follow. Oh, but at least Anne is having a good time. Just watch her. She's laughing as Kong has trouble with the ice. She's having the time of her life. No thought in that blonde head about how tragically this is going to end for them. I mean, come on. How do you break up with an 8,000-pound gorilla? Anywhere at once, right. And then these horrible people have to come along and ruin their date, firing on the giant gorilla. I mean, it's not like he killed anybody. Okay, well, he did kill some people. He didn't mean it. He's just a sweetheart, really. So King Kong climbs the Empire State Building. Classic, classic movie moment. I've made Lego sculptures of the Empire State Building, and when I did, King Kong was climbing it, and there were airplanes circling it. It's another thing that movies do, and I know why they do it, and I'm actually with them for doing it, but it takes a lot of, you have to stretch the truth quite a bit. King Kong breaks out of the theater at night. He finds Anne Darrow. He and Anne go on their first date. Then he decides, let's climb this building. As he's climbing the building, the sun is coming up. I could see maybe an hour having passed since he broke out of the theater, and that's being generous. So the big theater on Vegas, it's also wintertime, the big theater show was like 6 o'clock in the morning? That seems weird even for New York. Oh, and Anne is wearing a dumb outfit. It's not the nightgown she was running around Skull Island in, but it's a skimpy dance costume. She's got no coat, no gloves, no scarf. It's winter in New York. She's out in the open air, 1,200 feet in the air. She's really an amazing woman. She's not even slightly shivering. No goosebumps to be seen. That's right, she's not in the dance costume. She's gotten into a dress at this point, I think. Yeah, more on the dress later. And even as these airplanes come after King Kong, Anne is just looking horrified because not, oh my gosh, I might fall off this giant building to my death 120 stories below. No, it's like, oh, King Kong, you might die. What does she think is going to happen in this story? She starts climbing up to him when he sets himself on the top of the Empire State Building to swat at the airplanes. What does she think she's going to accomplish? This is a chance to maybe get inside or get down or get away from the giant monster. Can we really buy? No, we cannot buy that she's in love with him. I can't. I refuse it. One thing, again, I've been giving the movie a lot of hassle. I want to say something nice. The special effects were fantastic. You know, just because I found the giant spider hunt and the brontosaurus stampede stupid doesn't mean they didn't look pretty real. So, 2 hours, 49 minutes, 44 seconds, and Darrow is hanging from a ladder at the very tippy-top of the Empire State Building. Now, my brain knows that she's safe in a studio, that she's not even 3 feet off the floor, but I have a hard time watching that. My hands are sweaty. My heart is racing. All of the scenes where, I mean, let me say this. I'm not really afraid of heights. I love zip lines. I love, you know, rope courses. I recently, my wife and infant son and I were at Bryce Canyon National Park, and it's not as deep as the Grand Canyon, but there is a lot of, you can walk up to the edge and look over. And Tiffany, who's not as excited about heights as I, would not go up to the edge of some of the places. Even with a railing, she was like, or she might go up, she might peek over, but then she'd had enough. I was happy to lean against the railing and just stare. And I didn't feel afraid. I really didn't. Even though if I had gone over that railing, it was a long roll before I would actually get to the bottom. We visited the Hoover Dam last year, and that was a little disconcerting. To stand 3 feet of concrete away from this lip that just, it's just a drop, and you would just slide for a good 10, 15, 20 seconds and then hit bottom. That was a little disconcerting. But I could stand there on the other end of that lip, and it was only disconcerting to think how easy it would be to just kind of roll over and, you know, slide to my death. But sitting on my couch, watching this movie there at the top of the Empire State Building, I could hardly watch because it seems like they are really up there. Again, not really afraid of heights, but they did a great job with this film. I can't really say that, can I? They did a great job with the effects on this film that's incredibly very far too long. Yeah, now, I did write down that they probably didn't have safety glass back in the 30s, and when King Kong saves Anne and puts her on the balcony, she's lying on broken glass, runs to the stairway, not a mark on her legs and hands. They did actually have safety glass. Safety glass was invented in 1909, so there's a chance that that's what she's lying on, and she shouldn't be all cut up. I'm not sure I believe it, but okay, we're nearing the end of the film. And here's another thing. I'm pretty sure I thought about this even in the theater, certainly while nitpicking. Our heroine has been running around on the top of the Empire State Building for some time. She's in this pure white dress. Kudos to the cleaning crew that gets up to the top of the Empire State Building. They must do a top-notch job because her dress, she's on her knees, she's on her side, she's running around, she's falling, she's stumbling. Her dress is absolutely spotless, as opposed to covered in grime like you would expect. Also rather amazing, 2 hours, 55 minutes, 50 seconds into this movie, with all of the chasing around the city, she's climbing a skyscraper, she almost fell off a ladder, somehow she still has both high heels on. It's amazing. Oh, and then the tragedy, King Kong falls and falls and continues to fall and then finally lands. He's grounded for good. This is, I'll admit, this is grungy and in poor taste, but given that there's a depression on, given that they established earlier in this very, very too long film that there's a scarcity of food in the city, how much you want to bet there was a special on Gorilla Burgers that night, huh? Oh, don't look at me like that. You were thinking it. 2 hours, 57 minutes, 4 seconds. It wasn't airplanes. It was Beauty killed the Beast. Well, the fall might have had something to do with it. And so that is your introduction to the new PQRST series, the top 50 grossing movies of all times. I'm going to go through the nitpicking that I've already done, and Lord knows I did a lot of it, more on that later, and we're going to look at the stuff that I just find amusing. Hopefully you find it amusing too. I appreciate that you come on this ride with me, and I appreciate you, because this takes a lot of work, and I've put a lot of heart into this, and knowing that there are people listening makes it all worthwhile, makes it kind of worthwhile, makes some of it worthwhile, gives it an essence of worthwhileness. You know I'm joking around because I love you. I hope that you will go out right this second and own your stage, and that you'll come back for more next week. Movie number 49, what will it be? You'll find out there.